Hello, Catherine here. If you're listening to my podcast because you're a fan of wintering, the good news is that my new book, Enchantment, is available now. It's a book about how we can find a way to reconnect with a world that's sometimes hard to live in and even to find magic there. It's available in all good bookshops and please support your local indie if you can. For more information, you can go to catherine-may.com/enchantment. Happy reading.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at UH1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Catherine May, author of Wintering and the forthcoming Enchantment. And this is How We Live Now, a podcast that looks for pathways through this post-everything world. Each season, we ask a range of wise people a common question, and this time around, we're asking, how can we come back together again? Hi, I'm Catherine May. Welcome to How We Live Now, the podcast that explores the post-everything world. It's a sunny day. I always feel like I'm drinking in the last dregs of the vitamin D at this time of year before sunlight becomes in short supply. I'm loving the sound of crunchy leaves underfoot though. It's the best, isn't it? There's no better sound. I thought I'd just share that with you for a while. So, I'm excited today to share a conversation with you, with Ejje Tewakuram, who said she'd be sympathetic if I couldn't pronounce her name properly because British people can't make the right mouth shape. I'm going to take that with the kindness it's intended. Ejje is so well known in her native Turkey, where she gained a dangerous reputation for challenging the government. Tripped over, not for the first time. And now, because of the risk that would mean for her personal security, the risk of imprisonment, the risk of personal persecution, she lives away from her family, currently in Germany, but previously in Croatia. But whenever I speak to her, she's always somewhere in the world. She's a true global citizen. I don't know how she gets the energy, but there's some fire there. And I thought she would be an incredible early guest for How We Live Now, but also for this question of how we can come back together, because her latest book is called Together. And it's a true entreaty for us to abandon some of the hardening that we've undertaken as a collective consciousness, if you like, and to soften into a world in which we can expect to have enough rather than too much, in which we can listen and observe rather than shout back, in which we can make lasting friendships that nurture us rather than enmities, and in which we can have something greater than hope, something more solid, which is faith. I think she's an extraordinary writer, but she's also a courageous speaker, and she's funny and earthy and curious and all kinds of wonderful. I hope you enjoy the conversation, and I'll be back later to tell you how you can take part in it. Well, I am really excited to be back for a new season with a new name. So we are now How We Live Now, which is allowing me to answer some bigger questions, or at least to ask them. I'm not sure if we'll come to answer them fully, but we'll give it a go. And I'm here today with my very first guest, Ece Temelkuran, who is a Turkish journalist and author, most recently known for her book, How to Lose a Country, and Together, 10 Choices for a Better Now. Her work centres on a concern about the rise of right-wing populism and also the looming threat of dictatorship that comes from that. But I think most of all, her work turns to asking how we can fight this encroachment. And I'm thrilled to talk to you today. Welcome to the first episode. I'm really nervous. Is that ridiculous to be nervous on my own podcast? It's so
Catherine,
strange.
First of all, thank you for inviting me. And I am also thrilled. So don't worry about being thrilled. And yeah, it's so nice to be on this program. And it's nice, very nice to speak to you actually about these massive questions.
I just feel like those huge questions are the ones that I'm desperate to ask now. Like I can't think of anything else. We're in this period of such immense change and I feel a little lost, I guess. And I want to talk to people that feel less lost than I do.
Well, good luck to you about that. Well, I think on several levels, many people feel the same thing. I was in Barcelona a few days ago for Atlas Future Festival, and the theme of the festival was fixing the future. And I met these incredible people doing incredible work, very hard work. They are trying to reinvent the future, so to speak, in these end times, in these apocalyptic times. And I thought, wow. First of all, I was truly impressed and thrilled. But secondly, I saw how everyone is exhausted in a deeper level, and also how everybody is incredibly concerned about what is to come, especially for this winter. So we are not alone, at least in being concerned part.
It's maybe something that unites us, in fact, that sense of, exhaustion, jadedness, like ongoing frustration and enmity with how the world seems to be turning and how we can't seem to pull it back together again.
When I was writing Together, I thought this book is too early for Western audiences. I thought it was early. It was during the pandemic I wrote that book. Because, I wrote Together for those people who feel like we lost everything. There are no more triangulation points. We have no more bearings, neither on moral, philosophical, nor political level. But then now I'm seeing that people are coming to that state of mind, so to speak. Where do we go from here, or do we at all go from here anywhere? That is the general sense, I think.
I think we're definitely there. And actually, let's begin with telling your story a little bit, because I think that puts a load of this into context, really. And, you know, the sense that I always get the sense with you that you're a true global citizen, but that's for some very dark reasons, actually. So you began as a journalist in your native Turkey. Tell us what happened from there.
Well, I mean, like, that is like literally last century. that is 1993. I was 20 years old, or 19 even. Mm. I started journalism, and I was mostly concerned about those bloody issues, such as, you know, Armenian, Kurdish issue, women's rights. You know, I did a lot of political journalism. And then when I was 27, I was already a political columnist. Everybody thought that I was using my picture from years ago, although that was me. I was almost a child when I was a prominent, you know, columnist in a prominent newspaper. And then meanwhile, I published books in different genres, from poetry to political documentary, journalism books, novels, and so on. After AKP came to power, after Mr. Erdogan came to power, things got really problematic. And it was 2016 when the military coup attempt happened in Turkey. It became almost unlivable. The country became quite unbearable for me on several levels. It wasn't only the fear, but also being controversial, being in the opposition became not only fearful, but it became primitive as well, because somehow the level of oppression determines the level, intellectual level of opposition as well. Right. So anyway, I found myself not only terrified, but also intellectually paralyzed. So I decided to move to Zagreb. I had an apartment there, a studio apartment. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a, you know, premeditated decision. I went there for a weekend with two t-shirts and one pair of pants, and then I decided to stay.
Wow, that's a huge move.
Well, I've always been on the road, but that was, of course, different. And then starting from 2016, I began writing in English. How to Lose a Country and Together were written in English. So I had the torture of translating them to my own language, not them, only together, actually, to my own language, which was, oh, God.
Full of admiration for you that you do that at all.
Yeah, there was a translator, of course, Ayşen Tekşen, but I had to go through it, and it's so weird to see your words in your own language, but not your tone. And so, anyway, since 2016, my main job has become talking about authoritarianism, fascism, right-wing populism, especially to the Western audiences.
Right.
Because when I came to Zagreb, I realized that they have no idea what is to come. You know, they never thought that Boris Johnson would be a prime minister. They never thought that Trump would last more than a year.
Yeah.
You know, all these things were supposed to disappear suddenly in their point of view. And they were, you know, the Western audiences were absolutely angry when I was telling them that, you know, what we live through in Turkey is coming towards you, and you're going to practice, like experience exactly the same things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a woman with curly hair coming from Turkey telling the Brits that you are no better than Turks is something. That is a challenge.
We don't believe it can happen to us. I think you're exactly right. And actually, because we are so naive about this stuff, tell us, like, spell it out to us, what it means to be politically active in Turkey today. What would the risks be for you if you were still there? What is happening?
First, the word about naivete, I don't think it's being naive. It is more like, I wouldn't even say exceptionalism, but I think it is more like one cannot easily digest the fact that this madness is happening in one's country. When it was happening in Turkey, when it started happening in Turkey 20 years ago, we didn't want to acknowledge it. We didn't want to admit and accept the fact. And that's why maybe Turkey is in this situation, in this mess at the moment. Turkey now is a place where all the political bearings are too fragile to hold on to. So there is a one-man rule, and Mr. Erdogan single-handedly ruling the entire system, economic, you know, judiciary, political system. And, you know, the rest of the people are, you know, classified into two first-class citizens who are either members of the party or sympathizers of the party, or they just, you know, are obedient to the system, to the regime. And the others who are mostly fearing for their lives, many of them had to leave Turkey already, especially academics and well-educated people. The big capital in Turkey pretty much, you know, moved their quarters to either London, New York, or several other places in Europe. And so the country is drying up on so many levels. But most importantly, I'm never sure how to say this, but the joy of life is not there anymore. Turkey has always been a crazy country, more or less. But we had this joy of life. It's not there anymore. The depressed mood in Turkey is so solid you can touch it. And I would call it the grand retreat, the grand regression, because nobody wants to take the chances and risk their lives to say anything. So there is this deep and widespread silence in the country. And they're all waiting for the elections to come, which is supposed to happen in June 2023. And until then, everybody's literally holding their breath. And on top of all this oppression and suppression, there is a dire economic crisis. Inflation rate is over the roof, and it's record numbers, and the cost of living is unbearable even for upper middle class. This is it.
And it's so interesting that you said that, you know, you're ahead of us on that, and I think, again, like, that is the kind of thing that we Brits find it quite hard to believe, that other people are ahead of us rather than behind us, you know, and that's the problem. You feel very strongly that we've got this coming, right?
Yeah. I was...
Maybe.
Yeah. Well, I was almost beginning to write How to Lose a Country in 2017. No, 16. Brexit was happening, and it was the shock of Brexit in London. People were barely understanding that this is serious. It is happening. It's not a joke. And then Boris Johnson was not prime minister yet. And I was telling the audiences that you're going to have Boris Johnson and he will drive you mad. Not because he's going to be an oppressive leader overnight, but because he's going to do so many interesting and strange things that you won't know how to respond to them and what to do about them. But then, of course, British democracy is one of the most mature democracies, and somehow the establishment managed to sack him, so sack him from his job. But then I told this with Trump as well. When Americans got rid of Trump, they were so happy. But then I always want to remind them that, you know, the entire establishment had to come together to do that, to get rid of a clown. So it is not much different for Boris Johnson, and he didn't disappear. I think he
doesn't feel truly gone, I'd have to say.
I know. I was in London, and his ghost was haunting everyone still. And one more observation, and this happened in Turkey as well, when the domestic political situation becomes so maddening, and so, you know, everybody's occupied with this domestic conundrum that they, you know, they don't really know what's going on in the rest of the world. And Turkey closed in on herself just like this after Erdogan came to power. And I saw the same thing happening in London, which was interesting to me, because even the progressive circles, we're not talking about Chile where exciting things are happening, or they were not talking about European Union and this and that, but they were talking about still Boris Johnson and cost of living and, you know, how are we going to get over this winter.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
So this is another symptom. It's another symptom, I think.
Well, it kind of obsesses us with ourselves. And I mean, Absolutely. Here is the first kind of division that we can identify, because actually, even though to you and I, it seems self-evident that it's a good thing that Boris has gone, you know, 50% of Conservative Party members still think he should be there. And that's, therein lies the problem, doesn't it? That I cannot even think my way into the mindset that would believe that he could be a good thing for the country. And it's this sense, it's that sense of like that fundamental separation of views there that I think is the thing that we're grappling with.
Yeah. This is the thing. I mean, like, you can get rid of these guys, but then millions of minions are there. Mm-hmm. So, well, I don't want to be condescending, but obviously, I just did, I think. But anyway, the thing is, you know, how do we survive in such a polarized environment? Mm-hmm. Because it is not only supporting a party, it's a deeper division, like on a moral level, on a philosophical level, on the perception of the truth level. So neither Western world nor the entire globe has witnessed such a division before. We could have different political views, we could have fought each other over those views, but then we never had different grounds to exist. Now it's as if we are, you know, living on different grounds. So we are not even in the same ground to discuss or fight or whatever. We just exist separately. So that is simply why I actually wrote Together, because we need to go back to the basics, so to speak, basics of philosophy, basics of politics, basics of our understanding of life, to find a way to cohabit in these countries and in the world together.
And what I think came across really strongly for me from Together was the idea that to do that, we need to find something joyful and kind of pleasurable and, like, you know, to use a really weak word, happy, rather than, I don't know, the kind of sour kind of anger that we've got used to living with. And I, like, for me, I think that's part of the compelling nature of people like Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, is that they make it look fun. And maybe we on the left of the spectrum don't manage to make our vision of the world look quite so jolly. Like they look like it's a laugh, don't they?
Well, that's the other reason I wrote Together, because right-wing populism, all these leaders with fascist inclinations, they are masters when it comes to managing politics of emotions. And in hindsight, it might be more clear for people to notice that both Trump, Boris Johnson, Orban, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, all these leaders have come to power through their mastery in politics of emotions. Right. They didn't really promise anything. They didn't come up with a program, political program or anything. They just managed politics of emotions. They played with the emotions of the masses. And first and foremost, it was fear and anger that they played with. So when it comes to emotions, and I don't know if you'd agree with me on this, we progressives, we people who are pro-democracy, we kind of look down upon the word emotion and how emotions of the masses are shaped. We don't want to say anything about that almost. But this is life. This is reality. This is how politics on a global level is shaped at the moment. Yes, we have to have something to say about politics of emotions. Yes, we have to say something about anger, fear, what else? Like, you know, lack of attention, the sense of broken dignity, and so on and so forth. All these emotions are going to be shaping our politics in the coming decades.
So
we can complain and whine about the fact that rationale is not there, that, you know, people are not, do not care about facts and so on and so forth. But this is the reality, and politics, you know, resides in reality. It doesn't reside in some imaginary rainbow land, whatever. So we have to deal with this. And progressives have to have a consensus about these politics, their politics of emotions. How are we going how they are going to deal with these massive current and very determining emotions?
That's such an interesting way to see the divide, isn't it? Because the frustration, I think, that comes from both sides is this almost complete inability to communicate with each other. This total different language of what it is to be a political human being and how we might envision society. And I don't know if the progressive side is bringing the vision enough. You know, like it's almost, we've got to return to the idea of something being stirring. And the kind of right-wing populists have got these really big concepts like nation and, you know. And whereas we're uncomfortable often with those concepts, and we're uncomfortable even with talking about morality when at the same time we're deeply morally offended by what's going on. And it's such a gulf that we've got to bridge.
Yes, exactly. And yes, I know these words are absolutely dangerous, like morality, emotions, and my favorite word, faith in humankind, and so on.
Right, yeah.
But then we have to take these words back from the realm of religion, back from the realm of, you know, social madness, whatever. And we have to politicize them in a different way now, because these words actually belong to politics, if you ask me. This is one thing. And the second thing is, if we can go back to basics, like if we are brave enough to talk about fear, for instance, then we can even convince those people that have been supporting right-wing populism that they do not have to act on their fear in such a way that we can actually share that fear and we can steer the wrong political choices, and I say very confidently, wrong political choices towards something more constructive and more, I don't know, sane, it simply. So, that is why politics of emotions is important, because it somehow is the way to connect us to those people whom we think unrecognizable or like, you know, impossible to live with.
Yeah, we've got to bring the emotion back. So my question for this mini series of the podcast that I'm making is, how do we come back together again? And what I observe from your work, and please correct me if this is wrong, but you're focusing on the kind of softer approaches to this. You know, you say that, like, let's not get tempted by revolution because that brings chaos and it's destructive and it throws along a load of young people on the fire, essentially. So you're thinking about these very constructive sort of soft skill ways that we can come back together again. Can you talk me round that, the way that you thought about those 10 methods, if you like, when you were coming up with them?
Oh, well, Catherine, personally, I love the word revolution. I mean, like, it stirs me up, obviously. I'm like, it's the most sexy word. It's the sexiest word ever. But, you know, I've been doing journalism since I was 19, and I have been, you know, the most hellish places on earth, like war zones, the poorest countries, and so on. And I saw many people talking about revolution, and I saw many people sacrificing themselves for their own revolution, although, you know, because that word is used by so many different
people in different ways,
in a very contradicting way, in many contradicting ways even. So, you know, although I love the word, although I would love a revolution, I also know that it includes blood, period. That is it. That is reality. It doesn't happen just, you know, while we are chanting, we shall overcome. It is blood, and it's lives, and mostly young lives. I think at this point of human history, we can be a little bit smarter than the previous generations, and we can maybe convince people that this system, this neoliberal system, is not good for any of us, one, even for the, you know, the wealthiest. It's not even good for them. They're not even happy. And that we can actually transform it, because there is enough, there are enough ideas to transform this system. What we lack is the political will of people and political imagination of the people. So my problem in life in general is how we create that political will for a peaceful and, as you said, constructive transformation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe I'm getting old as well, because I feel for these young people who would sacrifice their lives for such a word and then be completely disappointed when the new status quo is built, as they see, as they will see that nothing really changes when the way you change the system is the same.
I mean, maybe I'm naive to kind of want this all to happen without bloodshed, but I can't get behind, as you say, this kind of, this vision, this glorious, like, macho vision of how we might overcome, because actually that's, it's not consensual either. And it would just lead to more violence, more conflict. It just doesn't seem to be the way. And I think the alternative is much harder and much less decisive. And it involves us all digging much deeper and like having to keep going back to these horrible debates that we hate having and this horrible sense of conflict and uncertainty. But it seems to me that that's the right way to do it.
Well, I mean, while we are talking right now, when we are recording this, it's Iranian women are dancing on streets without their headscarves.
Yeah.
So how did this happen? We never know. I mean, of course, there was a young girl, 22-year-old girl, who was killed by police violence because her hijab was not correct, whatever. Mm. And there have been many women since 1979 who lost their lives to this cause, for their freedom, trying to get their freedom. And many had to leave their country. So there is, it's not like, you know, suddenly one night everybody decided to rebel. But still, I see, you know, I was watching the footage from Iran, and I saw the police retreating when women were together they weren't wearing hijab. And it was so, like, incredibly touching and invigorating to see that. So we need to have a majority. How do we build that majority to transform a system is a technical and tactical question. We can deal with that later, but I think civil disobedience will be the answer in coming years, because my observation, especially in the Western countries, in the United States as well, is that young generation is removing their consent from the system. They do not want to work. They do not want to have a home, or they do not have the hope of having a home of their own. They do not want to live the happy life of the capitalist system. And they do not believe in this theatrics of democracy anymore, this representative democracy and its crumbling mechanism. So they are removing their consent. And there are millions of people like this. I think one of the most important problems in coming years, or in this coming year, will be to connect these people and articulate their demands, because they're not talking at all, not as much as they want to, or not as much as they think. But this removal of consent on a massive en masse will be a political reality that we will have to deal with. And how do we make that mass of people, how do we steer that mass of people into a civil disobedience movement? I think this would be one of the interesting questions of current politics, especially this winter.
We'll be back to the conversation in just a moment. But first of all, we know how hard it is to find new podcasts, and we thought you might love this one.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, we're the Book Cougars, two middle-aged women on the hunt for a good read. I'm Emily.
And I'm Chris. And we became friends through our mutual love of reading.
And soon after launched a podcast that's now entering its seventh year.
We talk about the books we're reading, have read, and hope to read.
And share biblio adventures of our literary explorations throughout New England, here in the United States, or wherever our travels take us.
We regularly interview authors and others in the world of books and host quarterly read-alongs with our listeners.
A new episode drops every other Tuesday. After 6 years, there's a big backlist you can dip into or jump right in with our most current episode.
Find us on your favorite podcast app or stream directly from our website, bookcougars.com.
That's bookcougars.com.
Happy listening.
And reading.
One of the questions that I keep asking myself, I suppose, not that I have the answer, but is why haven't we seen rioting yet? And I think there's some really interesting reasons for that. Mm-hmm. One of them being that the kind of bloodshed that's happening in our social media discourse feels to me like it's actually doing more work than we believe it's doing. Like it feels, we talk about it as so pointless and so indulgent, but I begin to wonder if that isn't actually patronizing to think that, and I wonder if it isn't doing much more work than we think it's doing.
It is too early for us to know this because like how many years has it been, Twitter or Facebook, you know, especially
yeah, like
their
15 maybe
yeah but their, you know, political, these, you know, tools being put into political use is since from Tahrir, I would say, or Greece mostly, but mostly, you know, Tahrir was the milestone. And then we started using Twitter and Facebook like more actively in terms of politics. What we know from history is that whenever there is a new communication medium, politics is transformed. We are going through that change now. And maybe you're right. Maybe we are underestimating it. Maybe it is doing something. But then we cannot know it because there is an incompatibility between our democratic mechanisms and the social media. We can, we can talk through social media, but we can represent ourselves on social media, but we cannot. We are still bound with the representative democracy in the conventional democratic mechanism. So our communication tools is not in accordance with
it's not matched up to the actual mechanisms of change.
Exactly.
So in many ways we can be fooling ourselves that we are having an effect when actually we're just being occupied in that space while other people go out and vote.
Well, that is true on one level, but then we are creating an atmosphere there, like in a political atmosphere. And, you know, yes, Tahrir is thanks to Twitter, actually. Not all of it, but a big part of it was thanks to Twitter and Gezi as well in Turkey. And today, you know, many ideas are developed in that sphere and people connect to each other. I personally connect to many people on Twitter. And, you know, I found my even, you know, literary agent on Twitter at some in the beginning. Yeah, yeah. I'm like on Instagram as well. So, yes, people do connect to each other. But what will become of all these all this web of connections is still not clear. But then lately, especially in the last few years after during the pandemic and after the pandemic, I see many small initiatives all around the world trying to reinvent every big concept like economy, politics, and so on. And all these people naturally connect to each other through social media.
Right.
And in that sense, I think new politics is determined by social media. It actually, you know, takes its human resources from social media. And it will keep on being like this. And we're going to see something, things, you know, beautiful new things coming out of these connections. And we will have to get back and thank to Jack on Twitter for doing this.
Oh, we're going to have to show him some gratitude eventually. Damn it! But I feel like we're learning so much about each other, and I think it's really the first opportunity we've ever had to know each other on this global scale, and that is as hard and as maddening and as complex and confusing as you might expect it to be. Like we've never processed information on this scale before, and our sense of justice is being expanded in a way that we haven't got a structure for coping with yet. I think we're in the middle of this big bang.
Oh, Catherine, I'm like, this is my personal problem as well, because I'm not a very social person, although I look like an extrovert. I am at heart, a you know, very, very, very introvert person. So I cannot connect to too many people, although my life is full of people. Mm-hmm. And I cannot process all these things, all this input coming from people.
Yeah.
Yes, that is a problem. And I see it happening in younger generation as well, because they know so many people, they have so many connections, they are overwhelmed. And I, for the first time, I think I understand why they feel so tired, not tired, exhausted, actually. Yes, because they are processing far more than we did in their age.
Yeah, it's huge.
It is, and it is massive.
It comes with such a sense of responsibility, actually, which is correct. Like, we should feel that sense of responsibility when we see injustice happening. But that doesn't mean to say that we can do anything about it. Like, those two things don't match. That massive sense of injustice and our complete helplessness are so painful for us to live with right now.
Yeah, that is why I think there are two contradicting or maybe completing trends at the moment. One is connecting more to more and more people, but also at the same time building smaller communities.
And I
keep hearing this word a lot lately, community. And with the pandemic, it became more, you know, visible and significant. People are tending towards small communities, be it a knitting club or a political party. But although they are connected to the rest of the world, they want to live in their own reality, which is actually healthy, because there's only so many people we can connect to, we can socialize with. And this, as you said, this is the first time in human history we are trying to do, you know, trying something beyond our limits.
Yeah.
In a way, in terms of capacity, socialization capacity.
I think the thing with living through a revolutionary time rather than a revolution is that it's not clear that we're in it. I think we'll look back on this and realize the constant change that we were enduring, and like maybe forgive ourselves a bit for not being able to change the world all in one go. but while we're here, there's a kind of horror to it. You know, there's a kind of sense of seeing everything all at once and feeling so abjectly helpless in the face of that. And we we haven't got an answer for that yet. And in lots of ways, I feel like the progressives are trying to answer that for all the world at once. Whereas the kind of populist right is much more comfortable with saying, no, let's focus on our country and our, you know, and then you get those really sort of quite horrifying definitions of sort of ethnic groups coming in that kind of closes down towards, you know, a very narrow definition of whiteness or of nationality.
Yeah, their job is easy because,
it's really simple. Yeah.
There's only one paragraph they have to memorize and keep on repeating. Whereas we are, you know, truly concerned about the situation and we're thinking about it, genuinely thinking about it. But then you are right. This is a terrifying time because it's a revolutionary time and revolutions do not happen overnight. And it became a different kind of revolution. I'm remembering Tahrir and I'm remembering now Black Lives Matter or Me Too. You know, they didn't maybe change something in particular, but they changed the fabric of who we are and fabric of our relation to each other and to the world. Yeah. So it was a revolutionizing thing. It was a revolution in a way. And I think many revolutions in the coming decades will happen like this, maybe. It will just become embarrassing to be fascist. It will just become embarrassing to be wealthy. Just like, you know, you cannot harass women anymore because you're embarrassed, because you're terrified. Mm. It will become embarrassing to be xenophobic. Maybe it will happen on this moral level in a way, all this revolutionary thing. But then these contradicting trends or inclinations are pulling us apart. I have a friend. He's a prepper. He's a secret prepper.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Exactly. But then he's working on the future of democracy as an academic.
maybe explain what a prepper is in this context. Not everyone's come across the term.
Yeah, I'm like, he's preparing for apocalypse, for the end times and so on. So, but he's also genuinely working, doing some amazing work on future of democracy. So who is he now? Is he a person who gave up or is he a person who believes in the future? I think it is both, and it's both for both of for every one of us.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think the dividing lines between what once would have been like very defined political views have moved, you know, and so you can now be a prepper and also someone who is, you know, deeply invested in improving society. Like, it's not necessarily contradictory, but those shifts are very hard for us to process in short amounts of time.
Yeah. But then that's why I propose the concept of faith against hope.
Yes.
In together.
I want you to talk about this.
Well, hope is a very fragile word for these times, and it's inconsequential because it doesn't matter if you're hopeless or hopeful. It doesn't change your political actions on a daily basis. And also, hope has become a commodity for the system to sustain itself, I think, because whenever you go on a commercial street in Europe, any street in Europe, you see all these advertisements, hopeful advertisements, buy a t-shirt, be the hope, buy more paperbacks, be the change, and so on. So there is, you know, several things wrong with hope, I guess, the concept of hope. That's why we have to make a deliberate moral and political choice of believing in ourselves and in other people, because faith is irrefutable and faith does not care about hope if it's a hopeful situation or hopeless one. It just does what it does. And I think as a human skill, faith should be taken seriously by politics. Although I am aware that it's a dangerous word, I think we shouldn't underestimate people's capacity to believe in something and their limitlessness when they believe in something. And this is a time we have to believe in a future, like, you know, because it is not actually there, maybe, but if we believe, we can make it happen.
And it's almost like hope is too fragile to hold that. We lose hope all the time.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, faith is more stable.
Yeah. It would take me 5 minutes to kill all your hopes and the audience's hopes about future. But then if you have faith, you're unbeatable.
I would like to think so. And also, I would love to ask you about the thing that you say about befriending fear. It's quite hard to say that. The idea that we can befriend our fear, that seems to me to be a much more dangerous concept in your former National Society than it is in ours at the moment. I mean, can people really befriend their fear when fear now means, you know, incarceration, torture, loss of life?
You're right. But there are many fears and they have been manipulated by the right-wing populism. It's the fear of the enemy, the stranger, the other. It is the fear of other nations invading your country. It is fear of Turkish refugees coming to London, and that's why Brexit happened. And these fears have been played with for quite a long time. So in order to make them less dangerous, I think we progressives might propose befriending our fears, because fear is a very precious emotion. We can do many things with it. We can be hostile because of our fears. We can be vicious and mean, but also we can accept our fear, befriend our fear, and then be in solidarity with the others who are also in fear. So we have many fears at this moment in time, like from climate change to, you know, gas bills this winter. If we can accept these fears, like human beings should, and then, you know, come together to talk about them in a more sane and serene way, then we can create a more constructive politics around our fears.
Right.
And as for Turkey, yeah, the fear has been dominating the country for quite a long time now, and it just muted almost all the voices in the country. There, of course, I have fellow citizens with whom I'm absolutely proud of, who are still out there in Turkey,
yeah,
speaking their minds, and I have the utmost respect for them, and I stand with them. But then fear should not be underestimated. All those who are silent cannot be counted as complacent. We shouldn't do that. It would be too merciless for people, against people. I mean, like, it would be, it would be too much.
Because the fear is real. The fear is irrational. And the,
exactly.
And not everyone has the capacity. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so should we be looking for center ground between, these factions, or should we be looking to persuade?
One thing, I cannot be friends with, you know, hardcore fascist person. So I wouldn't go that far proposing that. But then many people I see around who's clapping, you know, who's applauding these leaders are not, you know, exactly fascists. They just, some of them, they do not know what they're doing, and some of them do not have any other political options, like, you know, choices and so on. They weren't offered. And, you know, we have been through decades of depolitization. So it's only natural that we have these infantilized masses to work with.
Who don't have the kind of critical skills to unpick.
Exactly.
What they're being told and to analyze it and to...
Also, I mean, like, you know, for decades, especially since 1980s, this idea has been imposed on us, the idea of politics is dirty. You shouldn't be doing politics. That's why all these people have voted for these leaders who claim to be above and beyond politics, therefore clean figures.
Untainted.
We are trying to reverse a current that has been there for several decades now. It's not going to be easy. But I think we are in a quite good spot, especially this winter, because this winter it will become clear that all those words, you know, those big words you mentioned, nation, us, you know, making the country great again, they will see that there is no they're all in vain. I mean, like they have no consequence in real life. So maybe this winter is a good starting point for progressives to be more engaged and more faithful, I should say.
Yeah. And I was thinking about you the other day when I was on a train and got talking to a man who, first of all, like, very nice, just chatty. And then he suddenly started spouting conspiracy theories about the whole world being a simulation. And at those moments, I think we've all had those moments now where we think the conversation is what once would have been normal. And it suddenly veers off into an entirely other direction. And the, you know, like in those moments, I'm always at a loss of what to do, you know, because arguing with that person would have been pointless. There was no rationalizing what he was saying. I did try to a little. He was claiming that Joe Biden's a robot. and I was giving it a go, you know, but actually it didn't work. It wasn't effective because our terms of argument were so different. And kind of very quickly, I felt angry and frustrated and kind of like almost hurt by it, like almost like it was personal. His lack of rationality was a personal affront to me that I had to tackle. And I was thinking about what you say about attention over anger and the power of that in dealing with those kind of conversations. Is that a way forward the next time there's a guy on a train who thinks Joe Biden's a robot?
Well, my propositions might not be easy to practice on the spot on a train ride. But yes, I think, yes, attention should replace anger, because especially in that situation, which of course I experienced as well with the vaccine, anti-vaccine people, with, you know, several other things. That is why I said we're now on different grounds. We're not even fighting on the same ground. You know, you're meeting this person who has a completely different perception of life in every level.
Literally a different understanding of reality. You know, like that's where it is. That's how extreme it is.
Yeah, this is the consequence of our new communication medium. I mean, like we have many truths now. Okay, it's the open buffet of truth. So people pick what they want. But then I think this is a passing by phenomenon. It will pass in you know, in a few more years, and it won't be as strong as it is today. This, you know, the separation between the realms of different realities, so to speak. But attention is good for us, you know, in terms of not to lose it, one, and also it is exhausting to be angry at these things. So attention would lead us to a place where we can understand that this guy on the train is actually so afraid of things, so he cannot make it, you know, he cannot come with a, you know, proper explanation. So he just takes shelter in these conspiracy theories. So if we are patient and mature enough to talk to this guy about our own fears, about fear in general, maybe then we can come to a, you know, not a consensus per se, but like, you know, at least those grounds, those separate grounds of realities can come closer to each other.
A kind of reassertion of mutual humanity, I think, is almost what we need to do.
Yeah, I am, you know, it's not easy to love humans. No, seriously.
They don't make it easy.
No, they don't make it easy. And also, it is not easy to believe in humans either. But humanity is a bigger concept. And also to love them, to love humanity, to love, to believe in humanity is a moral choice. So that I made that moral choice because that was the only way to go if I don't want to kill myself. That's it. Otherwise, we are lost in our own depressions, and that's it. We need to believe in humankind, not because humanity needs us, but rather like for ourselves. And this is how people believe in God as well. It's not for God, it's for themselves. So that's why I believe in humanity, just to survive these times, actually.
And you talk a lot about choice, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, are we always able to choose? Are these really choices? And do we have that level of constraint and control that we'd need to make these kind of very big lifelong choices towards our behavior?
No, I don't think so. I'm not that existentialist. I am too old to be existentialist. But yeah, I'm 49 now. If you asked me this question like 10 years ago, I would have said, yes, we do have the power, la, la, la. But then no, actually we don't. And we are just a push and pull between our choices and our obligations, and we are all products of ideological project in our own countries. I'm a ideological project of Turkish Republic, you know, the secular democratic Turkish Republic. That's why I cannot live in that country anymore, because production line has been stopped. That, you know, that is cancelled out. But yeah, we are so many things, but we also have to choose to be our choices as well. Otherwise, why would we live anyway? Why would we think?
We can't afford to be passive in this anymore.
Yeah, at least we can think that we are not completely, we can imagine ourselves as, you know, powerful beings, powerful enough to make choices.
Yeah, and have a go at it.
Yeah.
This has been such an incredible conversation.
Thank you, Catherine.
Yeah, it's just been lovely. And it's really nice to ramble through these thoughts and to unearth the complexity of them. I want to ask you one final thing, really, which is, do you see yourself ever moving back to Turkey? And if you did, would you ever be able to reconcile yourself with the people that have driven this political movement that's turned you away?
That is the biggest question that I even don't ask myself yet, because I left Turkey when I was 44 and I started writing in another language. I wanted to survive and I still am surviving. So such big questions, such emotional, deeply emotional questions weakens me, and it takes away my strength, which I need very much to survive. So I'm not thinking about that, but I, of course, I want to be able to go back to Turkey. And also I want to be able to sit down with my friends, have rakı and fish on Bosphorus and laugh a lot, because, you know, humor, Turkish humor is a very particular one and it's massive. And I miss that. I miss it a lot. This language of yours, Catherine.
We do our best. What can I say?
I know. But Middle East, since we suffered a lot, we have, I think, a better sense of humor. With Egyptians and Lebanese, we are amazing. Like. So, yeah,
I miss humor, that.
Yeah, a lot of gallows humor. Yes, that is true.
Yeah, always the best kind. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I do hope you can return one day.
Thank you.
I mean, you have a home amongst your enormous community, which must at least be some kind of comfort. I think they,
absolutely,
you know, they adore you and hold you up a lot.
Yeah, I'm planning to write a book now about home and what is home in 21st century. I think home is other people for every one of us in this century. It will become so, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Catherine.
I don't know if you can hear that, but I was just listening to a woodpecker then. He's flown away. Such a distinctive sound. It sounds just like the cartoons, honestly. I think he's behind me now. He's busy tapping holes in those trees. As you know, if you've listened to the wintering sessions, I like to walk and think at the same time. And I was just reflecting on that conversation with Ece, which I think for me really made me more conscious than ever of how Western and specifically British my perspective is. It's so fascinating to talk to someone who is situated in a very different part of the world, towards the east of Europe and the west of Asia, who thinks in terms of Turkey and Iran and the Islamic world in a way that only comes into the periphery of my vision when I read the news. I think it's amazing to hear those different perspectives. And also hard, you know? It's hard because, as we talked about together, we as a species are almost unable to process the sheer amount of news that comes at us. And I actually think news is a bad word for it now, because I think, you know, what's happening for us is a deeper process of understanding that we've never been called on to undertake before. A process of not just knowing what happened in the briefest possible way on a news programme that we've watched while we're having our supper or making our breakfast in the morning, but knowing on a deeper, more human level, perhaps having contact with the people who are the news. We can't de-individuate them anymore. We can't see them as a baying crowd, because the way that we're living, how we're living, is putting us in contact with their actual voices, their actual humanity. You know, we're reading their tweets, we're seeing their Instagrams, and that's transforming this idea of news into something that becomes much more about events happening to a community of which we're a distant part. And I do think we should acknowledge how hard that is for us. What a difficult thing it is for us to process this level of compassion, this level of shared fear, which I know is not direct, but which transfers over to us. This kind of sheer bulk of understanding, of social understanding, it's bigger than we are. And I think it really helps to be able to talk to somebody who knows it firsthand, who can make sense of it for us, to have a guide. I'm so grateful for that. And I couldn't help but think, as I was talking about TikTok, actually, of all things, which I know that women of my age are supposed to sneer at, but actually I've been dipping into it a lot lately. It took me ages to train the algorithm. First of all, it just gave me young white girls doing their makeup and their nails. And I really, really couldn't be less interested in that. But I started to follow BookTokers. Feel free to follow anyone that I follow on there. They're all great. And I started to follow the people that TikTok threw up at me, who were just curious to me, just interesting, just outside of my own experience. And pretty quickly, I trained the algorithm to spit out things at me that are really genuinely unpredictable, that I wouldn't be able to find myself. And I'm now following people across the globe who are writing humorously and who are talking seriously about the issues that affect them and about what they know and how they know it. And it's actually given me deeper insight into that big complex world than any social media app I've ever been on before. And it's become a real pleasure. I don't find it addictive in the way that Twitter can be, but I'm happy to sometimes give it 30 minutes on a Sunday morning and to watch a Maori woman tell me about what it is to have people encroaching on her land. And a young Indian dancer show me the different expressive moves she's trained to make and what they signify. And to watch an Ethiopian woman explain how she cooks and why she doesn't feel like she's missing out on a single thing for not having electricity. And that for me is the gift of this, that I can dive deeply into the huge wide world and challenge myself to know it better, to know it more empathetically, to know it in a way that isn't hierarchical, that isn't patronising. It's actually a pretty good thing, honestly, once you get past the girls with the nails and the hair and the makeup and endless stuff about the royal family, which TikTok assumes I must be interested in. Anyway, thank you for listening. I hope you get outside soon. It helps, you know. And I'd love to hear what you're thinking in response to this. So in a moment, we will share some links for you to get in touch. And I look forward to sharing your views and your questions and your thoughts very soon. Thanks for listening.
And that's all for this episode. Thank you for being here to explore how we live now. To share your comments, questions, or answers, go to howwelivenow.info and write a message or record a voicemail. We'll be compiling the best ones into an end of season special. How We Live Now is presented by Catherine May, produced by Megan Hutchins and Buddy Peace, with social media by Sarah Horner and communications by Becca Pierce. For updates, show notes, and plenty of stories, subscribe to my newsletter at catherinemay.substack.com. And finally, please consider pre-ordering my new book, Enchantment. There's a link in the show notes.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.